You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars, because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drumroll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Of thee I sing, baby.
Hi, I'm Robert Schneider, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication, 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to Routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 6, the 1931 production of Thee I Sing, and with us today is the author of that chapter, Laura Francos. Laura is the author of the Broadway Musical Quiz Book, published by Applause Books in 2010. She is a regular contributor to castalbumreviews.com and previously authored a blog on unusual musical theater history, The Great White Wayback Machine. Her latest novel, Broadway Revival, has a time traveler curing George Gershwin's tumor and altering the course of Golden Age Broadway. I am excited to read that. And this makes Laura more than qualified to talk about the Gershwins and of Thee I Sing. Laura, I am so happy that you are joining us today.
I am very thrilled to be here. It was an incredible honor to be asked to partake in this. And when I saw the lineup, I thought, wow, I'm playing with the major leagues here.
No, please, you are part of the major leagues. Laura, the first question that we ask all of our authors is, what makes your musical of Thee I Sing a key musical?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going for it. You have the Gershwin brothers, George and Ira, and they're at the peak of their musical comedy skills. They are working very closely with their librettists, George S. Kaufman and Maury Riskin, two incredibly talented comedic geniuses. What they produced ended up being the longest running book show of the decade. It had a national tour, a second company in Chicago. It was the first American musical to have its libretto published in hardcover. It's the first pairing of William Gaxton and Victor Moore playing the romantic lead with a dash of mischief and his sort of inept buddy. They're kind of like Hope and Crosby before Hope and Crosby, and they'd go on to be in six other musicals after this one, great stage tradition getting started there. But first and foremost is of Thee I Sing is the first musical to win the Pulitzer Prize. And that distinguishes it from everything else.
And the other question we ask all of our authors is, why did you want to tell the story of Thee I Sing?
Why did I pick of Thee I Sing? Well, my favorite composer is Sondheim. My favorite show is Sweeney Todd. Why didn't I pick that? The reason I didn't, as much as I absolutely adore Sondheim and Sweeney Todd and company and all the other great shows he did, is because I have pretty much been steeping myself in 1930s Broadway for years. And that ties in with the book that you mentioned, Broadway Revival, where I have a time traveler saving Gershwin and then sticking around with nearly a century and a half of musical theater history to come in his head. And what does he do from that point on? Gershwin obsessed here. The 1930s in me.
It seems like a natural fit. Now, did the music of George Gershwin enter your life, or when did you realize that he belongs up there in the pantheon for you of somebody like a Stephen Sondheim?
Oh gosh, I've always loved Gershwin. From the time, I mean, I get my love of science fiction from my dad, and my love of musicals from my mom. And one of my earliest memories is looking into the great big stereo that we had that was a giant piece of furniture, and looking down and seeing the Columbia Masterworks go round and all the musicals. I was just in love with, but there was something about the Gershwin tunes that really, really stuck. I would say my favorite Gershwin song is They Can't Take That Away From Me. And that was something else that I loved with my mom, was watching us all the movie musicals and seeing Fred and Ginger introduce those songs.
So the Gershwins, and luckily George and Ira's music just does not seem to go away in the popular culture, which is wonderful. Nope. It seems like every 3 years we get another Gershwin review or a jukebox musical of some sort. Can you tell us a little bit about what was the career of George and Ira Gershwin like, and where are they in that career when Of Thee I Sing emerges?
Well, as is the case with a lot of the Golden Age songwriters, they were either immigrants or sons of immigrants. In this case, George and Ira's father was a Russian Jew who had come over and had a series of failed businesses. They lived in a bunch of different places all over the city because as Papa Gershwin's business failed, they'd pack up and move somewhere else, presumably so the creditors wouldn't always find them. George was attracted to music early. They actually got a piano that was supposed to be for Ira because he was the older son. And George sat down and just started playing it. And what they didn't realize is that he had been hanging out in a neighbor's house and learning to play their piano, their player piano. And they just thought, oh my gosh, he's the one with the musical ability. He gets the lessons, which was all right because Ira was even then gravitating towards words, obsessed with light verse, obsessed with song lyrics even then. His high school buddy was a fellow named Yip Harburg, who would go on to have a fantastic career. And they were both talking about how much they loved verse. And Harburg said, yeah, I really like these verses here. And Ira said, oh, well, that's Gilbert and Sullivan. Don't you know the music? And Yip was like, what, there's music that goes with those fantastic verses? Are you kidding me? And from that point on, they sat and listened to that. George quit school early. He became a song plugger at Tin Pan Alley. He started cutting his own player piano rolls, something he was very good at. A lot of them survive to this day. Those are fun. He started working as a rehearsal pianist for a Ziegfeld show and getting some of his songs interpolated into early scores. And he's still just in his teens at this point. The tragic thing about Gershwin, and this is one of the things that led me to want to write my book, is that really we only have about 21 years of his professional career. And then he was gone. That's really about all we got. A couple decades, and we should have had so much more. But in those early days, Ira wrote a few songs with him. And at that point, he kind of thought, well, maybe George's career is going to take off. And so he took a pseudonym. He called himself Arthur Francis. Arthur and Francis being their brother and sister. So it was a family tie-in pseudonym. And Gershwin worked with a few other lyricists. Buddy DeSilva would go on to have a fine career. And he had a huge hit with Irving's Caesar, a song called Swanee. Caesar had also written some, and DeSilva had also written some songs for Jolson, and Jolson picked up that and it was a smash. The next big part in Gershwin's early career started in 1924. We've got him doing the Rhapsody in Blue. We've got him doing shows that were taking off in London at the time. And he teams up again with Ira. And from that point on, Ira is his principal co-writer, principal lyricist. And that's really where it kind of takes off because it's as though with that 1924 show, Lady Be Good, you get Gershwin introducing the syncopated rhythms, the jazz influences into a Broadway score. And everybody went, whoa, what's that? And the leads in that show were their good buddies, brother and sister duo, Fred and Adele Astaire. Years before, but back when they were just getting started, either Fred or George said to one another, wouldn't it be cool if you wrote a score and we could be in the show? And yes, that is what happened. And from that point on, they started doing musical comedy, something Ira was very good at. Ira did not like writing love songs. It made him uncomfortable. It made him feel like squishy. He much preferred to be slightly satirical and comic. And I think Ira's comic songs are among the best ever written.
And if you had to imagine that somebody who's never heard anything in regards to musical theater whatsoever wanted an example, a prime example of George and Ira Gershwin's best work, what song would you hand that individual?
Wow. That takes some thinking.
Or on the flip side, maybe Ira's best work and George's best work might not be at the same time. So is there a lyric of Ira Gershwin's or a composition of George's that maybe could answer that question? It's such a great wealth of material.
To go back to your first question, I think maybe Our Love Is Here to Stay, because that just has so much of the melodic beauty that George was capable of. And it's Ira doing a love song, and I don't think it comes off as sappy or uncomfortable at all. I think one of the things that's utterly brilliant about the pair of them is that they worked almost in a symbiotic fashion. Generally the habit was for George to write the music and then Ira to fit it in. He described it as it's like working on a mosaic, and he's fitting in the words to fit in the spaces in George's music, and then the whole creates a picture. That's one of the things that was unusual about Of Thee I Sing, because except for two songs, they operated the opposite way. They were operating from Ira's lyrics first and then George's music. But if you look at what they do in Porgy and Bess, and they're in collaboration with DuBose and Dorothy Hayward, there's such an exquisite meshing of talents that one picks up on the other's strengths, and it just creates a phenomenal whole. It creates a mosaic picture.
Why do you think the work of the Gershwins is still with us almost 100 years later, when their contemporaries' work has become more and more obscure as time has gone on?
Because they're so damn good. That's the easy answer. But I really do think they are. They're just so good. There are places where I know people, including my idol Stephen Sondheim, have been critical of Ira for being sloppy. He also criticizes Larry Hart for the same thing, for being sloppy. And I just want to go in a corner and cover my ears and go, la, 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 Stephen, not listening to you. because the whole comes over so well.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's now talk about, how did the idea of the I Sing even come to fruition?
Okay. Of Thee I Sing came about because of an earlier failed political satire that the brothers had done working with George S. Kaufman, who wrote the libretto. And that was called Strike Up the Band. What happened was they sat down and they were going to do this show, and it was going to be a satire of war profiteering, of jingoism, of excess patriotism. And they put together this show, and Edgar Selwyn was the producer, and it did not hold up in Philadelphia. It didn't hold up at all. The critics liked it, but the audiences were staying away, and they were also having some cast problems at the time. And what happened then was it closed, but Selwyn said, you know what, if you want to go back to this material sometime and revise it, I'm down with that. You can do that. Well, everybody separated to some various projects, and nothing came of it for a while. But then the Gershwins sat down and they were going to do it again. And this time Kaufman was busy with other things. And he said, okay, here's this young man out of Columbia, Maury Riskin. I worked with him on Marx Brothers musical, Animal Crackers. And why don't you work it with him and just go ahead and revise my material. I don't care what happens. So they did it. And again, Selwyn produced. And this time the revised Strike Up the Band was a hit in 1930. But we have Ira and Kaufman at the back of the theater, and Kaufman is just unhappy with all of the revisions got made, even though he gave his blessing to it. And he said to Ira, he said, one of these days, I want to write a real political satire that isn't going to make any kind of concessions to anybody. And Ira said, what they ended up doing with Of the I Sing, that was it. And they, Kaufman even said, if we have to produce this baby ourselves, we'll do it. But we're going to get it done. And so they came up with the idea that they were going to tackle political parties. And the initial idea was called Tweedledee, because the differences between the two parties were like, you know, the twins in Alice in Wonderland, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, you can't tell them apart. And the conflict was going to be over a new national anthem. And that's how we get the Gershwin brothers in, because George was going to write two competing national anthems. And then the end of the first act was going to be this huge, big number where they'd be playing counterpoint. Well, Kaufman and Maury Riskin, who was working with him on this, they soon realized that this was not going to be enough to make a whole musical. That as Kaufman didn't like love songs interrupting his shows any more than Ira Gershwin liked writing them. They realized there was going to have to be some romance in here. So they said, okay, how can we get romance in here? And they came up with the notion that they were going to have a political candidate who was running on a platform of love. And the Gershwins at this time were out in Hollywood working on some films. And so they, Riskin and Kaufman, sent this long scenario, and they said, we want a love song that's going to sweep the country. And sure enough, that's what the brothers turned out. The first songs that they wrote were the title song of The I Sing and Love is Sweeping the Country. And those were the first two songs that were written the usual way the Gershwins work, with George doing the music first and then Ira chiming in. But from that point on, Ira took the outline, the scenario, the long scenario that Kaufman and Riskin had sent, and he developed a whole bunch of songs. And Gershwin George was the one who wrote the music to the songs that Ira had done. That's pretty much the way they worked. And it was extremely tied to the plot. George did get in, there were long segments where there was no music, no songs at all, but there was a lot of underscoring. And George was using pastiche. He was using musical quotes. There's a lot of humor just in listening to the underscoring that he chose. So they decided they're going to do that. And this is a very, very odd show. And they did get a producer for it. They got Sam Harris, who had done Kaufman's shows with the Marx Brothers, Coconuts and Animal Crackers. And Harris said afterwards, he realized, we got the Depression, it's hitting Broadway really hard. If theater on Broadway is gonna survive, it's gonna have to be novel. And sure enough, this show was novel. In fact, when he saw it, he said, well, that's different. And it was. So they put the show together really quickly. And one of the things that George said was, when it debuted on tryouts in Boston, it was a smash. There was very little that they had to do afterwards. It was clear it was going to be a huge hit. In fact, one of the few areas that ended up being a bit of a bump in the road was Kaufman did not like the title song of The I Sing, because it's, of course, Of The I Sing, baby. And he felt that baby was just so slangy, especially since, as it was, they were already, you know, kind of mocking national patriotic songs. And he wanted the brothers to throw it out and replace it with just an ordinary love song. And Ira and George said to him, they said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll keep it in on the tryouts and we'll see what the audience thinks, because they're the paying customers. And if they don't go for it, we'll do what you say. We'll rewrite it and we'll do whatever you want. Well, at intermission, what's happening in the lobby? All the audience members are going around and saying "Of Thee I Sing" to each other. And it became a slang greeting of the time. In fact, Maury Riskin reports in his memoirs that it was so popular that at Yankee Stadium, when Babe Ruth would hit a home run, the crowd would start singing "Of Thee I Sing" as the ball would, you know, fly into the stands. So Kaufman had to give in on that one. They adopted the song, and from that point on, it was a smash hit. And this was, as I said, the Pulitzer. We'll get into that, because that's the big thing about this show. But it also was one of the shows that they wrote a sequel for. Now, sequels do not generally work well on Broadway, and it didn't happen here. And the premise here was they were going to take the same characters. It was virtually the same cast, William Gaxton and Victor Moore again, only this time it was going to be the re-election campaign of John P. Wintergreen. And the sequel was called Let Them Eat Cake. And Ira said, in that case, they were trying to satirize, quote, practically everything. And it ended up being a great big mess, and it flopped.
Let me ask you, going back a little bit, if I can, in terms of satire,
yes,
what exactly did the authors want to satirize? Yes, there were political parties involved, with the ideal of Tweedledee, but what are they saying about political parties?
Trying to point out. The premise of the I Sing is we don't just have a candidate who's running on a platform of love, but the gimmick, and there is a gimmick, is that there's going to be a beauty contest, and our presidential candidate, John P. Wintergreen, the P stands for peppermint, according to George S. Kaufman, he is going to marry the winner of this national beauty contest, Miss White House. So I think one of the things that Kaufman was really trying to get at there is just how much national politics involve the cult of personality, a popularity contest. Who looks good? Who sounds good? And you've got that there. On the whole, even though Kaufman said they didn't want to make concessions, the satirical element in Of Thee I Sing is actually pretty tame. There aren't a lot of topical references in the libretto at all, or in the lyrics. There was one joke about Coolidge, which they ended up cutting during the run after Coolidge died. That would not have been respectful. But there's not much. They mentioned then presidential candidate Al Smith. But there's not a whole lot there. It's more of a gentle spoof. And they're mocking the parties in that they don't see them as having much difference between one another. In fact, the party that Wintergreen is part of is just the National Party. There are no Democrats or Republicans specifically identified in the show itself. It's a gentle satire.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shana Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shana Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Great expectations.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Do you think that this sort of satire has now opened the door for more contemporary musicals? And are there any threads that we can draw from elements of The I Sing to anything that we're having today in musical theater?
It was even back then. You had following of The I Sing. You had a lot of shows in the 30s that were using satire to address topical issues, either in the more serious vein, like of Cradle Will Rock, or in a more humorous vein, as in Rodgers and Hart's I'd Rather Be Right, which actually had George M. Cohan playing FDR. George F. Kaufman famously has the quip, satire is what closes on Saturday night. I tried digging up the source for that. The earliest I could find that referenced that was like late 1935. And even then it was saying oft-quoted George F. Kaufman yeah. line. Satire is hard to do. Satire is hard to pull off. People have to understand what you're satirizing, how it works, and what your intent is. There is a lot of satire still on Broadway. You've got Book of Mormon, you've got Six, you've got Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which I think is bloody bloody brilliant. It has a home, and it's always had a home, but it's the kind of thing that's hit or miss because it's difficult to do. It's difficult to pull off.
Do you think there's a place for Of Thee I Sing in a contemporary commercial revival?
Probably not. And the reason for this is I think it's much too closely tied to Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, interesting.
And that's just a kind of musical mentality that was prevalent in the 30s. You look at young Yip Harburg and young Ira Gershwin sitting there listening to you know, Gilbert and Sullivan records and being utterly obsessed. Everybody knew it then, and that's very much what they were going for, both in the original Strike Up the Band and then in Of Thee I Sing. It's patterned like a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, but with a very American theme. And I think that a lot of people today would find that off-putting because they don't necessarily know where it's coming from. And it sounds quaint. No, the back and forth with the chorus, repeating the lines and all that. It just doesn't come over as something familiar to today's audiences, I fear.
Have you seen any productions of it?
Have I? No, I haven't. Aside from the there's the abysmal 1972. Version with Carol O'Connor and Jack Gilford, and then the concert production from I think 87 with Larry Kurt and again Jack Gilford playing Throttlebottom. So I have not actually ever seen it live.
Neither have I. I think we're in the majority in that one.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about the Pulitzer Prizes.
Okay.
Prior to Of the I Sing being the first musical to win the Pulitzer Prize, some of the authors who won Pulitzer Prizes include Eugene O'Neill, Sidney Howard, Elmer yeah. Rice. These are people of great substance. Their plays are very substantial and dramatic. Why did Of the I Sing get in there? How did it compete with Eugene O'Neill and Elmer Rice?
How did it compete? It competed because it was so damn intelligent and coherent that it made everybody sit up and pay attention. When they first started giving out the Pulitzers, They included one for drama. It was specifically supposed to be for a play that reflected an American theme. Well, you can't get any more American than presidential politics now, can you? The award is administered by Columbia University. So you have a committee, and the committee consisted of two academics and one playwright. And when they made the announcement that they were giving it to Of Thee I Sing, they completely stunned the theatrical world because people just didn't think of musicals as high drama. Musicals were considered like one step up from minstrelsy or burlesque. That's a quote from one reporter that I ran across. It's something that was inane, that was incoherent, it was fluff, it was fun. Well, this was fluff and it was fun, but there's a great deal of thought behind it. There's a great deal of intelligence, and it's a completely integrated score. Yeah, there were a couple of tunes that they were able to pull out that became hit songs, but most of the numbers in Of Thee I Sing are so deeply connected to the plot that you can't pull them out. You can't pull them out of context. And the committee, the Pulitzer committee, felt they had to defend themselves. And so they issued a statement saying why they made this unusual choice, because they knew they were going to get flack, and boy did they get flack. And I like to read part of it because I think it exemplifies what was unique about Of Thee I Sing. So they say, our choice is unusual, but the play is unusual. Not only is it coherent and well knit enough to class as a play, aside from the music, oy. But it is a biting and true satire of politics and the political attitude toward them. It may well be this play will influence our stage as much as the Beggar's Opera influenced the 18th century stage and Gilbert and Sullivan that of our fathers. The award will have an excellent effect on future productions, helping to rise the tone of popular musical comedies. So they were recognizing Of Thee I Sing as a landmark that they hoped others shows in the future would follow. And while we have a huge backlash, I mean, the announcement was on the front page of the New York Times. They gave the Pulitzer to a musical. What happened was all of those naysayers who were saying, ugh, this is cheapening the award, this is lessening the value of the Pulitzer, how could they do this? They're giddy, they're insane. The losers, which included people like Eugene O'Neill for Morning Becomes Electra and Robert E. Sherwood for A Reunion in Vienna, they should protest. They should stage a protest. But even in those articles where they're criticizing this choice, every one of those naysayers acknowledged the intelligence, the thought that went into making Of Thee I Sing. So even they could tell, yeah, okay, this is amazing. They didn't think it should get a Pulitzer, but they recognized it as something definitely out of the ordinary.
And one of the things I find fascinating about this, did every single person who contributed to the writing of Of Thee I Sing get honored?
No, as the committee said, aside from the music, you can class this as a play. So no, they left George off. They awarded the Pulitzer Prize, $1,000, to Ira for the lyrics and to Kaufman and Riskin for the libretto. And they divided the $1,000 among the three of them. And Kaufman took the extra penny because he was the oldest, but they didn't want to take it. They were furious that George was dismissed. And George said, no, you should take it anyway. And here's what they ended up doing with it. Kaufman donated his entire portion to a theatrical charity. Ira hung his certificate on the bathroom door. And Maury Riskin, he got the greatest revenge of all. Maury Riskin, as I said before, had been a student at Columbia University. But just before he graduated, he got expelled. Why did he get expelled? Because the president of Columbia University, Nicholas Murray Butler, was incensed by a satirical piece that Riskin had written for the school newspaper. He was complaining because Butler had refused to allow Leo Tolstoy's nephew to come and speak. And so he wrote this satirical piece where he called Butler Tsar Nicholas. And Butler said, "You're out of here, kid. You don't get your diploma. You're expelled." He has to hand the Pulitzer certificate to Maury Riskin. And Riskin reported, he said, "Butler could not make eye contact with me. He just refused to look at me. He just handed me the certificate and off I went." So, yeah.
Did the committee ever make it up to George Gershwin? I know that he didn't have a lot of time to do it because he passed, but did they ever try to make amends?
No, what they did was later in life, I think on his centenary, they awarded him a posthumous citation.
And even though Of Thee I Sing was the first musical to win the Pulitzer Prize, not many other musicals have won the Pulitzer Prize.
Nope. Only 9 others. It kind of averages out to about 1 per decade.
I was just going to ask, do you see any elements of Thee I Sing in any of the other musicals that won the Pulitzer Prize?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. The 1960 winner was Fiorello, and the 2016 winner was Hamilton. And both of those are political based shows. And 1962, How to Succeed won, and that's probably the greatest satirical musical of all time. And I think there's definitely a bit of the I Sing's DNA in that show.
And let's talk a little bit about two names that are sort of getting lost in musical theater history, and that's Gaxon and Moore. Can you tell us a little bit more about what they might have been like on stage and a little bit more about their careers?
Okay. Well, Gaxon was hired because they wanted somebody who would look charming and have a bit of sex appeal. And Kaufman was like, "Well, yeah, I don't know from that, but okay, Harris recommends this guy, so let's have him." And Moore, on the other hand, had already had a history with the Gershwins. He had played very much the same kind of bumbling character as Alexander Throttlebottom, the vice president whose face everyone forgets. He had played those kinds of characters in a couple of previous Gershwin shows. And in fact, that was his forte. I mean, that's just exactly the sort of character he would play. They played off one another really well because Gaxton's characters always had a little bit of a dangerous flair to them, a little bit of mischief. Definitely, he was not merely just a handsome leading man. There was a lot of humor there, and they just bounced off one another brilliantly. And after Of Thee I Sing and the failed sequel, Let Them Eat Cake, they paired up again in Anything Goes. They paired up again for another Cole Porter show in Leave It to Me. They were in Louisiana Purchase with Irving Berlin and a couple of other flops. But they really were Hope and Crosby before Hope and Crosby. It's that exact kind of comic pairing. Right down to, you know, Moore's characters always sort of wistfully wishing that he got the girl.
Would you say in some way it's sort of like a Nathan Lane, Matthew Broderick type situation where they get paired a lot on stage, or a totally different analogy?
There's something to that, because both pairs, they've got the comic chops, and you need it to pull off something like that. You need the timing. You need that kind of flair. I don't think Broderick's characters are necessarily as bumbling as Moore's always tended to be. Leo Bloom and the producers. He's good at being an accountant.
Yes, yes.
He may not have a lot of other skills, but he's good at that.
Is there anything in the text of the I Sing that still in 2021, when we're recording this, still feels could be quite relevant? Obviously, the role of the vice president has changed a little bit since this.
Oh, yeah, there definitely is, because I was looking over it again in preparation for our little chat here. And there's one point where Throttlebottom and Wintergreen are talking, and Wintergreen says, if I'm impeached and you have to be, you're the vice president, you have to take over when the president can't fulfill his duties. So you'd take over. It's a good thing. I'm working on a book. I'm working on a book called a Young Person's Guide to the Presidency, something like that. And he says, of course, the first 4 years are pretty easy because all you do is run for re-election. And I thought, okay, this is 1931, but it's still totally relevant.
Oh, God, yes. Now, one of the things I did not know until I was reading your chapter was that the Marx Brothers had looked at adapting this into a film.
That was kicked around, but it was clearly not a Marx Brothers production. It's their stuff was specifically written for their characters, and it would be really hard to try to figure out how to interpolate the chaos of the brothers into this scenario. There were a couple other times that there was the possibility of doing a film. In fact, once with Hope and Crosby, that pretty much failed. Also in the 40s with Fred Allen and Jack Benny, and that was kind of derailed by the war. It just wasn't going to come about. So it never happened.
Was there any sort of criticism about the show when it first premiered, as people saying, this is un-American, this is mocking our American foundation, our system of government? Or did everyone pretty much go, yeah, I recognize this?
That was actually a little bit of a concern, both to the creators and to the people involved. There was one exchange that Gaxton and Moore reported, like, do you think we'll get arrested for this? Gaxton says, and Moore says, I don't know. Some people take the, you know, the dignities of high office pretty seriously. Right from the get-go, all of the politicians were just totally on board with this. Mayor Jimmy Walker was, in fact, the model for the character of Wintergreen.
Oh,
and
wow.
He was there at opening night and loved it. New York Senator Robert Wagner was there. The governor of New Jersey was there. FDR saw it later and loved it. He sent Gaxton an autographed picture. And said he was, he's still a candidate at this point. And he said that he was going to make Throttlebottom his running mate. They loved it. They loved it. And but they were worried, but the politicians loved it.
Great. And, you know, if someone were to open up a dictionary today, I believe.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about how it entered the dictionary?
Yes. We don't have a whole lot of cases where you could specifically say that Broadway musicals have contributed to the English language, but Throttlebottom is now a term for an inept, bumbling, not very good politician.
So.
Some people thought that John Nance Gardner, who was one of FDR's vice presidents, was the basis for Throttlebottom. That's not exactly correct, but Gardner is the one who said about the vice presidency that it wasn't worth a warm bucket of spit is the word that's usually used, but that's not what he said originally. He said something else, not worth a warm bucket of
fill in the blank.
Yes, fill in the blank.
Now, you had alluded earlier to the, I believe, 1972, 71 production of The I Sing, which was televised,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you can see it on YouTube. And listeners, mm-hmm. there, we have a link to it. If if you want to watch it. But Laura, should we venture in?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, great.
I am not a fan. It's altered in some ways. They didn't have at that point, the original orchestrations had been lost. And so they resurrected some of them when they did the 1952 revival, that they found more of them later. And that's what was used in the 87 production, I believe. Mm. So it doesn't quite, the 72 one doesn't sour. And I love Carol O'Connor, but I don't think he's Wintergreen. That was a big thing for CBS. They were going, look, Archie Bunker is running for president. No. Yeah.
I saw some ads that was on that marketing train. Yeah. I'm surprised with all the influx of Gershwin jukebox musicals that we've had over the past 30 years that nobody has attempted to take this show, which is still the themes of it are contemporary and relevant, especially the idea of having a beauty contest, which in a lot of ways parallels our obsession with reality television today.
Yeah.
And not trying to bring this show into the 21st century with using other Gershwin songs and stuff like that. Do you know if anyone's ever tried to attempt anything like that?
Not that I'd heard. I think it would take some doing.
Yeah. And then you start fiddling with a great book. And I, you know, it's so funny. I was rereading the script a couple of days ago and still laugh out loud at it.
Yes.
So I think there's, unfortunately, maybe they knew this, but in 100 years, it's not going to be that different. So bless the Gershwins for being so prescient and being able to see that things were not going to change. Laura, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us today. The chapter is absolutely fantastic. And I can't wait to read your book, Broadway Revival. When does it come out?
Well, right now I am talking with a cover artist.
Amazing. Once
we get the cover artist, then we will go from there. But I'm hoping it could be out by the end of 2021, but more likely early 2022.
I love that. And is your blog still active, The Great White
Wayback
Machine? I'm so curious. I know it covered unusual musical theater history. Can you give us some examples of unusual musical theater history?
I became obsessed with cows in musicals.
Okay. I'm trying to think how many. I mean, I can think of Caroline from Gypsy.
Yes,
that's the first one that comes to mind for me.
Yes, definitely.
There's Milky White and Into the Woods.
Yes. Okay. This is a tradition that goes back to the 19th century, and there would be a dancing cow in early shows then, and this was recycled again when we had the 1903-1904 first musical version of The Wizard of Oz. Dorothy did not have a little dog that accompanied her, but no, there was a cow.
You learn something new every day. You came here for Of Thee I Sing and you got some Wizard of Oz trivia. So this is great. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. Listeners, please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about Of Thee I Sing, please also review the links in the below description. I'm Robert Schneider, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast. Bye-bye.
Of thee I sing, baby, summer, autumn, winter.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.